From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's Only a Game. The Cubs are in hibernation, and the Scarlet Hoes are full of runs, so that must mean the World Series begins tonight. Ahead on Only a Game, can Florida Fish defeat New York's allegedly evil empire, and will anyone watch? Also, a conversation with Barbara Holland, author of Gentleman's Blood, a history of dueling from swords at dawn to pistols at dusk. Also ahead on Only a Game, a California museum hangs photos, hangs paintings, and hangs 10 with its current exhibit on the art culture of surfing.
Visitors come in and they will confess to me that they walked up and when no one was looking, they touched Velo. And this is almost like the holy grail of surfing to a lot of surfers.
Stay tuned.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall. President Bush today became the first U.S. president since Dwight Eisenhower to address a joint session of the Philippine National Congress. The speech emphasized common values between the U.S. and the Philippines and common threats. NPR's Vicky O'Hara reports.
President Bush said the United States and the Philippines both have been victims of terrorism, and he vowed that the two nations will work together to stop it.
We know the enemy wants to spread fear and chaos. Our two nations have made our choice. We will defend ourselves.
The Philippines has an ongoing problem with Muslim and communist insurgents. The U.S. is concerned that instability in the country could attract terrorist groups from other regions. President Bush assured Philippine President Gloria Arroyo that the U.S. will help in any way it can. He announced that Arroyo has committed her government to a 5-year plan to reform its military. Mr. Bush pledged U.S. technical and financial assistance to that effort. Vicky O'Hara, NPR News, Manila.
A top Pentagon general has apologized for statements he made about Islam, but he did not take back his remarks. Army Lieutenant General William Boykin says he never meant to offend Muslims. In several speeches made at evangelical Christian churches, Boykin said the real enemy in the war on terrorism isn't Osama bin Laden, but Satan. Describing a 1993 battle with a Muslim leader in Somalia, Boykin said, quote, "I knew my God was a real God and his was an idol." Boykin's statement of apology said his comments were misinterpreted. After 3 days of deliberations, a jury in New York failed to reach a verdict yesterday in the trial of former investment banker Frank Quattrone. Jurors say they disagree over the evidence in the case. NPR's Brian Mann reports.
Federal prosecutors have worked hard to convince this jury that Frank Quattrone impeded two separate investigations into Credit Suisse First Boston. Quattrone led the bank's powerful technology investment group, crafting some of the biggest dot-com deals of the 90s. On Friday, U.S. District Judge Richard Owen summarized a note from jurors saying they had substantial disagreements on the issues in the case. Quattrone smiled as he left the courtroom, but he and his lawyers had no comment. Prosecutors hope to prove that Quattrone urged bank employees to destroy records in a deliberate effort to block probes by a federal grand jury and by the Securities and Exchange Commission. The jury continues deliberations on Monday. Brian Mann, NPR News, New York.
Investigators from the National Transportation Safety Board are examining the Staten Island ferry that crashed into a concrete pier on Wednesday. They're demanding blood and urine samples from the assistant captain. They're trying to determine if his medication played a role in the accident. This is NPR. 6 people died in a deadly fire yesterday in a high-rise county administration building in Chicago's Loop Business District. 10 people are being treated in hospitals. As the fire spread, workers made their way down stairwells. Chicago Fire Commissioner James Joyce says the people who died appeared to have been trapped in a stairwell around the 22nd floor. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention has put out a plan to prepare the nation for the possible reappearance of SARS this fall and winter. NPR's Richard Knox reports.
Public health officials everywhere are on edge about a possible return of SARS. Dr. Larry Anderson led CDC's SARS Preparedness Committee.
I don't think anybody knows if it will return. We hope not. But I think we need to plan if it does return, because we do know that SARS can be controlled if the response is prompt and appropriate. It can be controlled fairly quickly.
The draft plan runs 168 pages. It advises healthcare providers how to spot a case of SARS against a backdrop of colds and flu, how to prevent the accidental spread of SARS within a hospital, and when officials should consider quarantining possible contacts of SARS cases or even closing schools and canceling public events. Richard Knox, NPR News.
The New York Yankees will face the Florida Marlins tonight as they open their 39th World Series. It's the sixth time in the past 8 years that World Series games have been played at Yankee Stadium. The Yankees have the edge in experience and pitching, but the Marlins have an advantage in team speed and youth. The Marlins have never lost a postseason series. They won the 1997 World Series. I'm Nancy Marshall, NPR News, in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Kresge Foundation, building capacity with challenge grants since 1924, on the web at kresge.org.
Major support for Only a Game comes from Bicon Dental Implants, since 1985 offering discerning patients and dentists options for same-day replacement of missing and compromised teeth. Information online at bicon.com or at 800-88-BICON.
This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield.
Let's go. Move someplace. Let's go. It's time to go home.
I'm
going
home this way.
Yeah, this is
great. The sounds of sodden despair and the uniformed personnel attempting to disperse the grief-riddled outside various establishments near Boston's Fenway Park early Friday morning. The Yankees playing at home won Game 7 of the American League Championship Series 6-5 in 11 innings when New York's Aaron Boone hit a Tim Wakefield knuckleball into the left field stands. A few of the disappointed Red Sox fans who'd been watching the game in the Boston bars were still capable of critical thought after the Sox had fallen in the Bronx.
Pitching, that's all where it is. We have the most unbelievable offense in the history of baseball, and we can't win a game. Excuse my language.
After Game 7 early Friday morning, there was among the Yankees a sense of self-confidence, certainly, but they knew they'd been in a battle. New York manager Joe Torre was not inclined to take much credit for the fact that his team prevailed in the 11-inning finale.
We were just hoping one of those knuckleballs wouldn't knuckle, and of all people, Booney, my defensive replacement. That gives you an idea how smart I am.
After the game, the mood outside Yankee Stadium was, not surprisingly, joyful. Jeff Barr, a New York fan and hence no stranger to celebration, was asked if he's spoiled.
You know what? You never get tired of this. I mean, you know what? We haven't won in 3 years, so it seems like a long drought. You're right. We're spoiled. I agree. We're spoiled. But you know what? For a while, I was thinking, you know what? This is going to be, I'm going to have to wait another year. You know what? This is so sweet. It never gets old. You know what? It gets better every year winning this.
Red Sox fans will have to take the word of Yankee fans for that, again. So will Chicago Cubs fans, having led in the National League Championship Series 3-1, the Cubs, who have not been to the World Series since 1945 and have not been champions since 1908, dropped 3 straight games to the Florida Marlins and saw the National League pennant slip away. Lenny Marullo, who played shortstop for the 45 Cubs, watched every gruesome moment of the 3-game losing streak. I asked him on Thursday how he was holding up following Wednesday night's 7th-game loss.
I felt drained, you know. I've been pulling so hard for them, Bill, you know, pulling so hard for them. And I know those fans out there. I know the whole country's pulling for the Cubbies. Everybody's pulling for the Cubbies. After they brought in the different faces in the crowd, I don't know whether you noticed it or not, and several of them were older women with a Cubs hat and a Cubs shirt on or whatever, and crying. And that's just what I did. They got me crying.
Lenny Marullo and I spoke in his basement office, which he calls the dugout. The walls are covered with Cubs photos, old baseball bats, even a pennant that once flew over Wrigley Field. I asked Lenny, who was born in East Boston, whether he'd be rooting against the Florida Marlins, the team that crushed his hopes by beating the Cubs in the World Series.
Oh, no, I'm going to root for the Marlins. We got to beat those Yankees. Got to knock them out of there. Yeah. We don't want those Yankees in there.
A scout for almost 50 years following his playing days in Chicago, Lenny Marullo is such a pure and worthy baseball man that he can't really be mad at any good team for long. Lenny's the sort of person who's inclined to find the best in anybody, and he's wise enough to recognize in Yankees manager Joe Torre several excellent qualities.
Oh, hey, you gotta love Torre, you know. Just that, just to watch the expressions on his face, you know. He's like coaching or managing a town team. And that's just what he looks like. He doesn't make a big issue out of it. And the way he handled that issue that they had, you know, that big brawl in there, class, yeah. With class.
Tonight in New York, the Yankees, winners over the Red Sox, will host the Florida Marlins, winners over the Cubs. Among those most delighted with the presence of the Marlins in the Fall Classic is Miami Herald columnist Dan Le Batard, who's been chronicling Florida's unlikely season. He joins me now on the line. Dan, welcome to Only a Game.
Thank you for having me on, and you'll excuse me if all of South Florida is hyperventilating behind me.
Well, that's exactly what I want to get to. You have written that nobody outside of South Florida wanted to see the Marlins in the World Series. You think even folks in the Panhandle were rooting for the Cubs?
I think that anyone who cares about baseball, who cares about sports, thinks that what is happening in South Florida at the moment is right on the cusp of evil, because you have these Cubs fans and these Red Sox fans who have been suffering all of their lives. We've been paying attention to this team for approximately the last 8 minutes, and all of a sudden, they can't lose a playoff game. South Florida's laughing. Like, everybody wants us to look down in our shoes in shame, but we've got our chest out, and we're just laughing at the baseball nation.
Dan, one of the more notable quotes to emerge from the National League Championship Series was attributed to Marlins second baseman Luis Castillo, who said, quote, "We always go from backward to forward." Do you want to translate that?
Louis is an interesting character for a million different reasons. He has a very no-brain, no-headaches approach to baseball. He misplaces his glove between innings. He doesn't do any scouting reports, doesn't know what the names of the opposing pitchers are, never mind what they throw, gets on team flights without knowing where they're going. This is a true story about Louis Castillo, okay? He's in St. Louis, and this is going to exasperate anybody who cares about baseball. He's in St. Louis, and they say, "Louis, you're a base stealer. You know, you want to meet one of the most famous base stealers ever? You want to meet Lou Brock?" And his response is, "Well, who is Lou Brock?" And so later, they bring him a famous cardinal, and they're like, "Louis, do you know who this is?" And he's like, "Lou Brock." And it's Stan Musial. So this is the team that's made it to the World Series. They're just hitting the ball, running around the bases with their arms over their heads. It's crazy.
That's baseball.
It's exactly how we planned it.
Marlins manager Jack McKeon was plucked from retirement to run the show down there. He's 72, the same age as hard-charging Yankee bench coach Don Zimmer. How much of Florida's success is attributable to Jack?
Well, I happen to be one of these people who believe that slugging percentages, on-base percentages, anything that goes out in the batter's box, it has very, very little to do with the old fat guy who squeezed himself into a uniform in the dugout. I don't believe in the powers, the mystical powers of managers. I think they're all overrated in sports because we've turned them into these self-help authors and, you know, we pay them $40,000 a speech to motivate our sales staff. But I will say this, the team is 30 games over 500 when this man is managing it. And now, again, we can make fun of this because I'm not kidding you when I tell you that Jack McKeon earlier this season, and this isn't to dabble in ageism, but these are true stories. Earlier this season, he came out to the mound and pointed to the wrong bullpen to make a bullpen change, wanted a reliever from the wrong bullpen.
Well, maybe he thought that other bullpen was better and offered him more choices.
There you go. Well, the players, see, he still confuses some of his own players with their names, and they think that it might be part of his genius, that he's just doing this to keep the clubhouse loose, because he'll come in and, you know, he'll want Chad Fox to get an out in a big situation. Chad Fox will get it, and afterward he'll, you know, slap him on the rump and say, "Way to go, Nate Bump," you know, and they'll be like, "Really?" Like, and they'll just laugh at it because they're not sure whether it's real or not, but it's certainly working, whatever it is.
The Marlins were previously owned by a profiteer, Wayne Huizenga, then by John Henry, who now owns the Red Sox and is, I gather, regarded in Florida as something of a carpetbagger. And the current owner is Jeffrey Loria, who presided over an empty ballpark in Montreal. Is this a team that just delights in succeeding despite ownership?
Yeah, these are not easy people to love at the top of this organization because they all feel like carpetbaggers. That said, Jeffrey Lurie has done everything within his economic means this year to win this year. He spent money when the team got close. He has done everything that he possibly can within his means. He's not George Steinbrenner. I mean, the amazing thing about the Yankees here is they've got one contract in Derek Jeter that's worth almost four times as much as all the Marlins are making. This is a team that's, you know, I'm not making that up. You can't make this stuff up. That's a mathematical fact. The Marlins this year, their payroll is $50 million. Derek Jeter's guaranteed contract is $189 million. And that's only one of their $100 million players. They got another one at first base, but they don't fear anything. They've already knocked out Barry Bonds and Sammy Sosa. What's there to fear?
You may have answered this question in part, Dan, but can fans in Florida possibly comprehend how fortunate they've been?
No. Well, first of all, I mean, they've been fans for the last 10 minutes, so they don't understand what genuine suffering is. They think the genuine suffering is that they've had to wait 6 years for this thing. I will give you the example closest to home, literally, for me. My father, you know, he's been to a handful of games this year. All of a sudden, my father is complaining about everything. Why did we leave the bases loaded? Mark Redmond didn't pitch very well. He feels entitled, like it's his birthright for some reason, to win every playoff series that they play in. And this team has never lost a playoff series. He doesn't know what it feels like to actually have your heart broken. So that's how South Florida feels right now.
In the World Series, the Marlins will face the most accomplished franchise in the history of pro sports. Are the Marlins even conscious of this?
Well, the Marlins don't have anything in the way of fear. Like I told you earlier, Castillo doesn't know Lou Brock and Stan Musial. He's not going to be scared by pinstripes. They know the history involved. Their Mike Lowell, their third baseman, for example, came up in the Yankee organization. But this team doesn't get nervous. This team is filled with joy. I don't know what ebullience and enthusiasm is worth or how you measure it empirically. When you're looking position by position, you can make the argument that the Yankees are better than the Marlins at every single position except right field. I could also turn around and make the argument based on the magic that I've seen that the Marlins will sweep them in four games, because nothing I've seen with this team makes any sense.
Dan Le Batard is a columnist for the Miami Herald. Dan, thank you very much for speaking with me.
All right. Thanks for having me on.
You can take a closer look at this week's stories, peruse our archives, or sign up for our newsletter by visiting our website at www.onlyagame.org. It's 18 minutes past the hour. It was the best thing that's ever happened to me, said high school freshman running back Vanessa Lucero last Saturday afternoon. At 14, Lucero had run the ball in for her first touchdown on a one-yard play in the first quarter of the game, which West Las Vegas High went on to win over Pohake High 67-0. Lucero's six-point scamper fulfilled the plan of coach James Escobel, who said, I wanted our kids to go down in history as the first football team to have a female score a touchdown. Of his teammates' triumph, quarterback Mike Martinez said she plays her heart out and she deserves it. Vanessa Lucero is also the homecoming princess at West Las Vegas High.
I'm Bob C. with these sports headlines. In yesterday's NHL action, the Dallas Stars doubled up the Washington Capitals by a score of 4-2, and Ottawa shut out Anaheim 3-0. The World Series begins tonight as the Florida Marlins face the New York Yankees in the Bronx for Game 1. The championship-deprived fans of New York hope their team can finally win it all, while the fans of South Florida cheer on the Marlins, which until now suffered through a World Series drought that lasted a whopping 6 years. For Only a Game, I'm Bob C. in Boston. We'll be right back.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Ahead on Only a Game, a history of dueling, which has nothing to do with Pedro versus Roger or Dontrell versus the Moose. But first, last winter, high school basketball was brought to the national spotlight courtesy of LeBron James. On Friday, one of the South's most successful high school football programs will challenge the best from the West in the first nationally televised high school football game in more than a decade. As Ben Trefney reports, this latest development in the world of prep sports has many wondering just where the professionalization of amateurs will end.
Paragon Marketing Group partner Rashid Ghazi arranged the December 12th game between LeBron James St. Vincent St. Mary High School of Akron, Ohio, and top-ranked Oak Hill Academy of Mouth of Wilson, Virginia. When Ghazi learned that the game was seen in over 1,600,000 homes, he got an idea.
We said, well, if LeBron was the big story in high school basketball, what could be a phenomenal story to put on the air in terms of high school football? And, you know, the biggest high school football story for the last number of years has been De La Salle and their phenomenal winning streak. So we thought, wouldn't it be neat to put De La Salle on television as well?
De La Salle High School of Concord, California fields America's top-ranked football team. The Spartans broke the high school record for consecutive victories back in 1997. They haven't lost a game since 1991, amassing 144 straight wins. When Ghazi called athletic director Terry Edson and offered to find a nationally ranked team to play De La Salle on national television, Edson did not hesitate.
This one was a no-brainer. It was a home game. I mean, no class time was missing, and we get to stay in California, so that to me was a real simple one.
Now all De La Salle needed was an opponent. Evangel Christian Academy of Shreveport, Louisiana, the USA Today's preseason number two team, seemed the logical choice.
D-Rod Duron sends Parker in motion coming toward us. Here's the fake, play action, throw downfield. He's got a receiver in the end zone, touchdown!
The eight-time defending Louisiana State champs started their own 60-game winning streak in 1996, capped by a consensus national title in 1999. The Eagles' 2003 schedule already featured matchups against two other state champions among three regionally televised games. But that didn't stop Evangel coach and athletic director Dennis Dunn from accepting the invitation to play De La Salle. Dunn says he's just following a trend.
You've got kids who are barely out of diapers that are competing on teams in all kinds of sports, and it just seems to be a direction that we're going in America in terms of you know, where a lot of emphasis is placed.
The national polls, busy travel schedules, and made-for-TV games, once reserved for college football teams, have become increasingly common for prep schools.
Well, you've got to wonder what it has to do with education.
American Studies professor Murray Sperber of Indiana University has written several books dealing with the corruption of amateur sports. He wonders whether high school students can withstand the intense recruiting and increased media coverage.
It's inevitable that high school sports would be ramped up and run increasingly like college programs, which are run increasingly like professional teams. I know of college players are very distracted by the travel and the media attention and such, and have trouble focusing on their studies. You've got to wonder whether high school kids can do it better than college kids. I'm very skeptical about that.
Mark Tennis, executive editor of Student Sports Magazine, a recruiting guidebook, has watched the attention on high school football develop over the last 20 years.
My first impression was this would be great. I mean, it would be a good thing for high school football, but if you're just broadcasting the games for the sake of the games and trying to build ratings and strictly trying to, you know, makes money off of it, I think, you know, you might, in turn, might not send out the right message.
Terry Edson admits he's concerned about De La Salle's football players.
We just like to play the competition, but there's other things that work with high school students, and one of those is, you know, getting them to see, you know, the school does not want to turn high school sports into big business. That's the one thing we're definitely very leery of.
Rashid Ghazi of Paragon Marketing Group hopes Friday's game will be about big business. His company is paying De La Salle what it calls a $7,000 appearance fee. The group will also cover Evangel's travel expenses. Ghazi says he hopes this is just the start of national high school football on TV.
We believe that on a one or two game a year basis, you can put together some really compelling matchups. In order for that to continue, we've got to be able to get a rating.
For Only a Game, I'm Ben Trefney in Concord, California.
In Gentleman's Blood, subtitled A History of Dueling from Swords at Dawn to Pistols at Dusk, Barbara Holland writes, quote, "There was much to like about the duel," and she celebrates the one-on-one sword or gunfight as an improvement over the informal ambush or sending henchmen to break the enemy's skull by night on the highway. Barbara Holland joins me now from her home in Virginia for further discourse on dueling throughout history. Ms. Holland, welcome to Only a Game.
Thank you for having me.
You write of our own diminished and dueling-deprived days that, quote, "the confrontational glory is gone, and that was the whole point." I gather that you don't regard our current games of confrontation as an adequate substitute for the duel.
So impersonal, for heaven's sake. I mean, they may cheer a lot, but nobody expects that the members of one basketball team personally want to kill or even injure the members of the opposing basketball team. I mean, the personal element is gone, if you know what I mean.
Well, I know what you mean because I've read your book. Insults have a great deal to do with duels, personal insults, not just the standard sort of trash talking.
Yes, of course. And if you were really touchy, especially, say, the maybe 18th century French, for instance, you could insult somebody just by looking funny at his hat or his beard or something like that, and he would have to challenge you, and naturally you would have to meet him, or everybody would call you a coward and a poltroon. A lot of people got killed that way.
Yeah, and sometimes the wrong guy got killed. I mean, sometimes the person delivering the insult was victorious in the duel, and everybody went away happy anyway.
I know. This is very hard to figure out. Samuel Johnson brooded about it. But the way everybody talks about the glorious chance to wash away this stain on your honor, you'd think that the offended man always won. But no. I mean, first you insult the man, then you go out and kill him, adding injury to insult.
So to speak.
Really, it was most unfair, but people convinced themselves it was fair somehow.
Your book is full of lively accounts of remarkable duels. One of my favorites comes quite early in the text. Tell us the story of the man who faced a greyhound on the dueling ground.
Uh-huh. Well, the greyhound was the only witness to his master's murder. And what was the man's name? Mackay, I believe, mm-hmm. who killed the greyhound's master. And the greyhound went promptly back into Paris and went to the home of a friend of his master's and led the friend to where the body was buried and scratched at the ground. And the body was dug up and decently reburied, and the greyhound moved in with the friend. And every time in social life it happened to see or run across the murderer, it was a very gentle and well-behaved dog on the whole, and it flew right at him, and it would take two or three guys to haul him off. So this was reported to the king, and the king decided this was definitely an accusation, and there would have to be a trial by combat. So the murderer was armed, and the greyhound just had his usual weapons, and they went to the appointed place with witnesses and so on, and the greyhound flew at the man and grabbed him around the throat, and the man said, pull him off, and I'll confess, and he confessed, and was hanged on the gibbet and disemboweled, and everybody agreed that justice had been done.
I mean, you can't make this stuff up.
No.
Now, when most people think of duels, they probably picture two men and their seconds, perhaps, in a lonely field somewhere. But some of the duels that you chronicle drew a lot of spectators. Sometimes there were even bleachers, right?
Yes, exactly. And, well, in America particularly and all through the South, there would be standard meeting places for a duel, and everybody would know about it ahead of time, and they would all troop out or row out to the island and the river and all stand around cheering for their man, and I'm sure bets were exchanged. And, yeah, it was illegal, but not necessarily private. It's a very nice distinction there. Prosecutors almost never bothered to bring the case to trial, and when they did, the jury didn't even bother to leave the box. I mean, it was, the man had behaved like a gentleman.
One of the more bizarre duels that you describe, this one involving two human beings and no dogs, but it did draw quite a crowd. It occurred at an altitude of about 2,500 feet back in 1808, and it was not, I gather, altogether sporting.
Well, no, but perhaps they hadn't laid down the rules carefully enough ahead of time. But anyway, they disagreed over a lady and decided that since they were had elevated minds, they would fight an elevated duel. So they went up in two hot air balloons with blunderbusses. And when they had risen to a sufficient altitude, the first man fired at the other man and missed. And the second man, which really does not seem the least bit sporting, fired at the very much larger target of the chap's balloon. And so the fellow and his second fell and were dashed to pieces on the housetops, and the victor sailed some 20 miles away outside of Paris and landed unhurt.
As you say, perhaps the rules should have stipulated that one couldn't shoot the other guy's vehicle out from over him.
Exactly. I mean, most people played according to the code duello, but it doesn't mention hot air balloons.
Not surprisingly, you include perhaps this country's most famous duel in your book, the one in which Alexander Hamilton and Aaron Burr faced each other. It was, I gather, an affair more dark and complicated than the history books usually acknowledge.
This is why nobody can remember why it was fought, because actually nobody really knew why it was fought. It was a question of gossip and really reading about America's founding fathers and their founding sons. It was amazing the level of malicious gossip that went on in the upper professional levels in this country. Apparently, after the ladies had left the table and the gentlemen settled down to smoking and drinking, they said the most appalling things about each other. Mm-hmm. And Hamilton had said something about Burr, which was so awful that nobody would even tell Burr exactly what it was. And there was a great, 6 months' worth of voluminous correspondence went back and forth before they finally met each other. And Hamilton somehow, rather, I suppose, because he died, is remembered as a bit of a hero. But he started it all with saying something absolutely foul and stinking about Burr. I have my own theory about what it was he said, but nobody knows for sure.
And your theory is in the book, and we'll let people read the book to encounter it.
Yes.
Okay.
I mean, if it was too beastly for Burr to mention, why should I mention it?
As we go through these duels, discussing them, and as a reader goes through your book reading about the duels, one after another, people die, sometimes in terrible and bloody circumstances. Did it ever feel to you, reading or doing the research, writing this book, my goodness, this is ghastly. Perhaps I shouldn't be putting all this down.
No, I can't. After all, very few of them died against their will. They made their wills the night before, and they went forth fully prepared to die. Mm-hmm. And some of them died perhaps more gruesomely or more lingeringly than they would have expected or liked. And what seemed to surprise them more than being killed was killing someone. A lot of them were really, they had come forth prepared to die in this noble cause, and they looked down and they have killed their opponent. And it wipes them out. For some reason, they weren't expecting to kill him.
You did, obviously, voluminous research, as the cliche has it, to write this book, and it must have been great fun. Have you a favorite encounter among all the encounters in Gentleman's Blood?
I particularly like, what was his name, Sainfoy, a Frenchman who was famous for many, many duels, and he walked up to a guardsman, and he told the guardsman that he smelled like a goat, and the guardsman challenged him. And Sainfoy said, "Put up your sword, you idiot. If you kill me, you will not smell any better, and if I kill you, you will soon smell much worse."
Barbara Holland is the author of Gentleman's Blood, A History of Dueling from Swords at Dawn to Pistols at Dusk, published by Bloomsbury. Ms. Holland, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you very much for having me.
You're listening to Only a Game. The charm of the duel is not hard to appreciate, especially if you're not directly threatened. The complexities and permutations of the challenges and parries leading up to the confrontation notwithstanding, the event itself is attractive for its simplicity. Two armed gents face each other. The games which preoccupy us today are much more complicated. They come bearing baggage, or at least the baseball games do. We know the major leaguers are mercenaries. They follow the money, except for the ones who have so much money that they can afford to instruct their agents to get them traded to or bought by a team that has a genuine shot at a championship, even if the relocation means a pay cut. Wherever they land, the most fortunate players establish temporary connections and become part of that most fragile of entities, a team. All teams are mutable. So far, so good, and so simple. But we complicate matters, as it seems we must, by assigning qualities to each team, no matter who owns them, how much money is lavished upon them, or who actually wears the Boston uniform, the Red Sox are doomed. No matter whether they win or lose, the Cubs are lovable, also doomed. Seasons in which New York doesn't win everything are anomalous, if not perverse, because the Yankees are indomitable. The qualities of the fans of each team are no less distinctive. Those who love the Red Sox are masochistic, or their closet Puritans convinced that suffering is necessary and ennobling. Those who love the Cubs take suffering for granted, too, but they're not nearly so loudly proud of doing so. They're more inclined to shrug, smile, and shake their heads than grind their teeth and roar into the wind. Yankees fans, even the ones who eat from dumpsters, are haughty and imperious. They are, they feel, entitled. Once upon a time in Manhattan, I dropped 50 cents into the cup of a homeless Yankee fan. Before I'd taken three more steps down the street, I felt the coins hit me in the back. The Yankee fan was outraged that I hadn't given him more. I don't know why we create these myths about our baseball teams. I guess we do it because we must. We are a storytelling species. It has to drive some of the rational players who find themselves in the uniforms of the most freighted teams nuts. It must make them yearn for simple days, free of chatter about ghosts, legacies, curses, and magic. Maybe on the nights when they see most clearly how little hitting and pitching and fielding and throwing successfully describe our squirrely baseball landscape, they dream of a simpler challenge, like dueling. It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR in Boston, where Only a Game is produced. Additional support comes from Thermo Electron, the scientific instruments company with a mission to advance drug discovery, improve manufacturing, and protect people and the environment. On the web at thermo.com. And from Nutter, McLennan & Fish, working to solve critical legal issues on local, national, and international levels. Information at Nutter.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Senior citizens dance in Miami's Little Havana. Horns blare in the bombed-out streets of Kosovo. And steel drums ring below Broadway and a New York subway platform. I'm Scott Simon. These sounds of our world on Weekend Edition Saturday from NPR News.
I'm Bob C. with these sports headlines. In yesterday's NBA preseason action, Toronto nicks the Nuggets 86-81. The Clippers clobber the Cavaliers 95-90. The Grizzlies of Memphis mauled the Magic of Orlando 84-65. The Knicks stopped San Antonio by a score of 88-74. And the Lakers stymied the Suns 91-84. Elsewhere, Boston bested New Jersey 95-90, Miami down Detroit 84-71, Indiana outpaced Minnesota 96-93, and Utah edged Philadelphia 87-86. For Only a Game, I'm Bob C. in Boston.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, the art of surfing, or at least the art inspired by the sport. But first, our look at the week's sports news with analyst Charlie Pierce, who joins me this week from the studios of member station WUNC in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. Hello, Charlie.
Good morning, Bill.
Oh, yes. Well, the World Series begins tonight. How do you like that matchup between the Cubs and the Red Sox?
Oh, man, I wish it would. I enjoy living here in 1908.
In the land of denial.
Oh, actually, though, Bill, the question of what you're going to get me for Christmas is solved.
I'm ready.
Grady Little's head on a stick.
Well, I'm sorry, but the list is very long, and Grady Little only has one head. So you are not the first person to ask me for that particular gift.
It's sort of the Tickle Me Elmo of this year's Christmas, I think.
Boy. Is it a disservice to the Yankees and Marlins, or just an untruth, to say that nobody cares about the series we ended up with?
Well, I think fewer people care about the series that we ended up with than would have cared given the alternatives. I think it's a particular disservice to the Marlins, who played extraordinarily well in very, very, very difficult circumstances. I'm leaving that other team alone for the moment.
Well, you can't leave that other team alone because you've got to tell me which team's going to win, Yankees or Marlins.
You know, I think the Marlins may beat them, which will really drive Red Sox fans up the wall, because that will mean that the Florida Marlins, who didn't exist 15 years ago, will have won two world championships.
The unfortunate fellow who has become notorious for preventing Moises Alou from catching a foul ball in Wrigley Field during Game 6 of the Cubs-Marlins series has been offered asylum by Florida Governor Jeb Bush. You think he ought to take up the governor on that offer?
Well, there are those of us who would argue that Florida has been something of an asylum since 2000, but that's neither here nor there. He was also offered a free 3-month vacation at a Holiday Inn in Pompano Beach, the manager of which argued that it was the least that Florida could do for him. But can we split off a few people from the lynch mob to go visit the Cubs shortstop's house while we're at it, by the way?
Charlie, switching gears for a minute, I noticed that LeBron James of the Cleveland Cavaliers failed to inspire a sellout at Cleveland's first home exhibition game. Is the NBA on the ropes?
Well, he also failed to inspire his teammates, and neither did he inspire himself. He had a terrible game. He didn't hit a shot outside 15 feet. You know, if you wander into the big Aristotle's kingdom, you have to have to accept that you are not going to be the show, no matter if you are the most heavily hyped, you know, teenager since, you know, one of the Backstreet Boys.
The story of Rush Limbaugh's comments about race consciousness as it applies to the National Football League have largely faded by this point, I think. But Tampa Bay Buccaneers tackle Warren Sapp has leapt into the vacuum, saying this week that the league is characterized by, quote, a slave system. This is a serious charge. What exactly is Mr. Sapp's complaint?
Well, he's been fined for dancing through the other team's pregame warm-ups after being warned not to. I think it's obviously a trifle overstatement. The attitude of most NFL executives towards the basic fundamental disposability of the human body is somewhat reminiscent, but not quite. The salary structure is a little bit different.
I should say so.
In that there is a salary structure.
The folks who run the WNBA made an interesting decision this week, Charlie, perhaps to the dismay of bench warmers throughout the league. The WNBA will suspend operations during next summer's Olympics. Good idea?
Yeah, it's not even an unprecedented one. The National Hockey League did it a few years back, so their players could play in the Olympics. I think that, you know, there is no bigger stage for women's basketball than the Olympics, and I think that if the WNBA will profit from whatever stars are created there and taking a little break in the middle of the season is not a good, not only a good idea, but perhaps the only decision that could have been made.
A great many Division I college basketball coaches met this week to address various ethical problems evident in their not-so-little world. Can we expect better times, or at least fewer violations and fewer embarrassed programs?
They mean it, Bill. They really mean it this time. They really, really mean it this time, Bill. They're not kidding around here. One of the proposals to prove that they really, really mean it this time was that if you didn't attend the meeting, they were going to take away your complimentary tickets to the Final Four. Now, all this does is punish a bunch of assistant coaches and graduate assistants who are going to take the tickets and scalp them at the Final Four and double their pathetic incomes. No, this is not going to change anything. This is a bunch of people. This is a PR move. And they all left after a while to start practice anyway.
Charlie, we should acknowledge the passing of Willie Shoemaker, who died in his sleep at the age of 72 on Sunday. He'll be honored at Santa Anita Racetrack in a ceremony on Tuesday. Surely one of the greatest jockeys of all time.
perhaps the greatest. And he did an interesting thing when he was going out. He did a series of visits and kind of complimentary appearances at racetracks all over the country. He came to Suffolk Downs in Boston, which is never be confused with Santa Anita, even on a rainy day. And he was just the most gentlemanly, fun guy. He talked to everybody. He rode, I can't even remember the name of the horse he rode. I was out there for the Boston Herald writing a column about it. But it was just very strange to see this guy who's probably the greatest at what he did ever, sort of, you know, hanging around with the home folks. It's almost like Barry Bonds would finish his career and do a tour of AAA stadiums.
In the From the Very Good to the Exceedingly Silly alcove in the Department of Racing Matters, Manute Bol, formerly of the National Basketball Association, will become the tallest jockey ever this afternoon at Hoosier Park Racetrack in Anderson, Indiana. But I gather it's all for an exceptionally good cause.
Yeah, he's once again working, as he has, I think, nobly over the past decade or so, for famine relief in his native Sudan and the aftermath of just a horrible civil war. I do get the feeling, though, don't you, that Manute's going to ride the horse kind of the way Fred Flintstone used to drive his car? Just kind of with his feet on the ground?
Manute is 7'7", so yes, that is a real possibility. Finally, Charlie, ruggers are apparently not as tough as they're alleged to be. By this, I mean people who play rugby, because in Australia, the site of the 2003 Rugby World Cup, the Scottish team has been ousted from their hotel by 200 bikers who go by the group name the Bandidos. Scotland has no chance once they get on the field, right?
Well, see, this is the way you settle this whole hotel thing. Put the rugby players on one side of the lobby and the biking gang in the other side of the lobby and one big keg in the middle. And you say, ready, set, go.
Charlie Pierce.
And then you build a new hotel.
Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Globe Sunday Magazine. He joins me each week in the Only a Game scrum, although it's a long-distance scrum. See you next week, Charlie, in person.
Thanks, Bill.
The baseball games of the past few days inspired many, many listeners to write Only a Game. Several of you, Red Sox fans for the most part, wrote full-fledged commentaries touching on such matters as free will, vile fate, and the stubborn yet admirable inclination of the human animal toward irrational belief. A Cub fan named Kirk Westfall left this verse on the listener line.
"'Twas the eve of the pennant, and all through the land, Cub fans were wailing, despair was at hand. With five outs to go and a three-run shield, the storm clouds gathered around Wrigley Field. There's no joy in Mudville, Chicago's north side, just sorrow in waves on its annual tide. The pennant was won, at least in appearance, till evil prevailed via fan interference."
Doug Gronberg emailed to suggest that Cub fans might feel better if they read a W.P. Kinsella story entitled The Last Pennant Before Armageddon, Kinsella and Gronberg contending that if the Cubs had won, it would be the last time anybody won anything. Tom Davison of Arlington, Massachusetts, submitted a cheery ditty which the fabled Only a Game choral group could not resist running by their suspect tonsils.
Take him out of the ball game. Take him out 'cause he's done. He gave up too hard. It's back to back. Pitched a great game, now he's getting off track. There are fresh arms out in the bullpen. We're only five outs away. Now there's one, two, three hits, you're out of the old ball game.
No more! Oh, no more! I did every year!
Thanks, guys. Don't quit your day jobs. Elizabeth Frazee of Quicksburg, Virginia, emailed just before the Cubs and Red Sox remembered who they were and acted accordingly. "I am not a sports nut," she wrote, "but I really enjoy your show. I lived in Chicago about 20 years ago and am now working in Boston. One thing the two cities have in common is the oft-heard comment, when the Cubs win the pennant or when the Sox win the series, as in, I'll pay you back when the Sox win the series. So are we about to see massive quantities of cash exchanging hands? Will this disrupt the economy, or is this the economic jumpstart the president has been waiting for?" Well, as it turns out, none of the above. Finally, Hilton Evans, a WBUR listener, has no use for my glee over the scientific finding I mentioned to Charlie Pierce last week. The universe is shaped like a soccer ball. He called the discovery questionable and maintained that, quote, soccer balls are more like Buckminster fullerene molecules. The infinitesimal size of a buckyball better compares with the WUSA's chance of making a comeback and displacing the NFL as America's game. What was the word Charlie used to characterize somebody who derives pleasure from another person's agony? Anyway, send your thoughts to us via the website onlyagame.org. Our email address is onlyagame@wbur.bu.edu. The listener line number is 617-353-1860. And our old-fashioned address is onlyagame, WBUR, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215. The first known California surfers took to the waves in 1885 after three Hawaiian princes rode their redwood boards off the Santa Cruz shore. Now, at the San Jose Museum of Art, an exhibit celebrates the history and culture of surfing as seen through the eyes of local artists. Jason Margolis recently took a tour and he files this report.
As one wanders through the exhibit titled Surf Culture, the Art History of Surfing, soft Hawaiian music lingers faintly in the background. Old 150-pound redwood surfboards from bygone eras hang on the walls, while cult classic surf movies play on television screens. Visitors to the exhibit are immediately awash in surfing sounds and images, which is the point, says Bay Area artist Thomas Campbell, whose work aims to capture the surfer's love affair with the sea.
It's just a special bond between the ocean and yourself. It's really soothing and relaxing and really challenging, extremely challenging.
Campbell's drawings, photos, and paintings depict the surf scene from Sri Lanka to France to Morocco. His documentary film, The Seedling, also plays on televisions in the gallery. Like most of the artwork here, his film isn't about surfing as competition, but as interaction between man and nature.
And it's really important that people realize the possibilities they have in their lives and their access to the ocean, you know. And that's a lot about what this movie's about. It's kind of educational and philanthropic and in that sense.
Exhibited directly beside Campbell's art is the work of San Franciscan Elizabeth Pepin, one of a handful of female photographers capturing women surfers on film. Pepin remarks that while women have made great strides recently in surfing, they're seldom pictured in mainstream surf magazines unless they're blonde and wearing a bikini. Her black and white photos show a different side of the sport.
I think women in all different shapes, sizes, ages are very beautiful. And I think my photographs reflect that. You also can see the joy in their faces. A lot of times I take pictures of them right after they get out of the water. And surfing is this amazing experience. It's so joyful. It's so playful. You're connecting with nature. It's beautiful. And that's reflected in the photographs.
Pepin also photographs from a unique vantage. She doesn't stand on the shore shooting with a wide-angle lens. She swims into the sea with her bulky waterproof camera.
You have to be able to swim for quite a long time. And you also have to have a surfer that's comfortable with basically aiming their surfboard at your head. And they have to get pretty close to you. You tread water, you take the picture, and in a split second have to dive down below the wave as it's coming crashing on you and as a surfer kind of surfs over your head.
Though the exhibit emphasizes the introspection, beauty, and solitude of surfing, curators did acquire a few appropriately gaudy pieces for the exhibit. In front of the museum, 25 life-sized mechanical hula dancers greet visitors and swivel their hips to Hawaiian music. There are psychedelic painted surfboards and film posters, as well as the original wetsuit of Jack O'Neill, whose innovation made surfing more tolerable in cold waters. And then there's the ordinary-looking kneeboard on a wall in the corner of the museum. Educational curator Margie Maynard says most people walk by it without thinking twice. But for those in the know, it's Velo, the handmade board of legendary surfer George Greeno, which he wrote in his 1968 film, The Innermost Limits of Pure Fun.
visitors come in, and they will confess to me that they walked up, and when no one was looking, they touched Velo. And it was, this is almost like the holy grail of surfing to a lot of surfers.
Though the exhibit doesn't seek to glorify celebrity surfers, no surfing gallery would be complete without acknowledgement of Duke Kahanamoku. A gold medal Olympic swimmer, Kahanamoku was surfing's most important ambassador, bringing the sport from Hawaii to the mainland during the early 20th century. At the exhibit, a small shrine honors the Duke, where visitors like 17-year-old John Reynolds feel compelled to leave something small behind, pictures, poems, or even a coin.
Whatever I got in my pocket, try to find a nickel or something just to say I left something in memory of the Duke.
Reynolds, who goes by the nickname Big J, has been surfing in the Santa Cruz waters since he was three, when he and his father would ride tandem on a board. This was his first time coming to check out the nearby museum. He said it was great to see the surf pioneers from his native Santa Cruz, as well as work by one of his favorite artists.
I'm just a big fan of Andy Warhol, and I had no idea that he had anything to do with beach culture. And to see him taking pictures of guys holding surfboards and being at the beach was really interesting to me, especially with the seagull here. I like that a lot.
Surf Culture, the Art History of Surfing, will be open through November 2nd at the San Jose Museum of Art. The exhibit will then be packed up and moved to Melbourne and Sydney, Australia, where it can be seen until February 15th. For Only a Game, I'm Jason Margolis in San Jose.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Gabe O'Connor. Our technical director is Michael Garth. Special thanks this week to Monica Brady-Meyeroff and Sean Carberry, as well as to the Only a Game Men's Chorus, the members of which would probably prefer to remain nameless. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To order a tape of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287, toll-free. CDs and cassettes are $15 postpaid. That's 1-800-909-9287. If you'd like to hear this program again, sign up for the Only a Game newsletter, or learn more about Gentleman's Blood, please visit our website, onlyagame.org. Our final word comes from former Chicago Cub and 1945 World Series participant Lenny Marullo, still smarting after all these decades, who shares his feelings about the Florida Marlins' trip to the World Series.
They don't deserve it. They shouldn't be in it. The Cubs deserve to be in it.
Yep, and if ifs and buts were candy and nuts, we wouldn't have to pay $4 for a ballpark hot dog. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Major support for Only a Game comes from Bicon Dental Implants, offering discerning patients a same-day tooth replacement solution for failed root canal treated or missing teeth. Information is available online at Bicon.com or at 800-88-BICON.
This is NPR, National Public Radio.